I will turn things over to Dennis Freilich, the ISO's Vice President of Grid Reliability, to get started with today's session.
Thanks, Diane. As always, welcome everybody and good morning. Hope everybody's enjoying the nice weather out there. I'll just let you know that we've got myself here to go through the presentation, but Biju Gopi is our Manager of Operations, Engineering, and Market Support. He's going to lead the conversation today. He has been heavily engaged over the last year in going through all the investigations on these system events that we're going to go through with you all. Ada, our Director of Grid Planning and Operations Engineering, isn't going to be here today. He's busy working on some other files for us. So Biju and I will answer as many questions as we can as we near the end of the conversation. Today, we're covering a few things. We're going to share the facts of several events that we've had on the system related to frequency response. Some of this material is quite technical, so keep that in mind as we go through it. We're also going to share the learnings that we've gained through what I would describe as fairly extensive analysis, review, and conversations that we've had across the generating fleet in the province, so that you're aware of the learnings that we've collectively gained. And then we're going to share the action that we're going to be driving, already driven as a result of the events, but also our action plan in the short, medium, and long term to address some of the complexities that we're seeing on the system as a result of our analysis of the events. Some key messages for you all is obviously this is a complex challenge on the system. There's numerous variables we're dealing with, and some of those variables are relatively unpredictable. We do understand the complex challenge that we've got in front of us. We have deliberately de-risked the loss of load to Albertans here over the last year based on the actions we have taken. And the de-risking of loss of load is tied to our under-frequency load shedding program and the triggering of that program for these frequency events. We obviously recognize that these changes have and may continue to have some impact on the opportunity service of imports, and I'm up for taking any questions on that at the end of the session as we go. We'll try to leave 15 minutes for Q&A at the end here, and answer as many as we can. And if we don't get to them all, we'll try to get back to you on those through our website. So recognizing time, I'm going to pass it over to Biju, and he's going to take us through the materials, and then we look forward to a good Q&A at the end. Thanks. Biju, over to you.
Thank you, Dennis. So in terms of what we are going to present today is kind of give a high-level primer in terms of what a frequency response looks like during a system event, followed by system event overviews of the events that we've had in June and October of last year and in February of this year. What the system response has been during those events, kind of walk you through those. I think most of you, if not all of you, are familiar with the June 7th update that we did last year. So I won't delve too much into detail on what transpired during that time period, but more into what we did following those events, basically the stakeholder engagement process. Like Dennis mentioned, we've had extensive discussions with the generator community in the province, with a lot of regulatory bodies, with other ISOs and RTOs, and I can quickly talk about those and what the findings have been for us in terms of as a result of those discussions. Then we would look into recommendations that we have kind of bucketed into short, medium, and long-term recommendations, given the time frame some of these might take to be implemented, and in terms of next steps, what we propose to do. So in terms of frequency response, this is what a standard frequency curve looks like during a system event. And what I wanted to focus on is the second half or the lower half of the slide, which talks about, the three modes of control that any entity has, a reliability entity has in terms of managing a frequency event. The primary frequency control that happens quickly within the first few seconds or cycles of the event. And that is dependent on factors like inertia, fast frequency response, how much LSSI you have in your system, as well as governor primary frequency response, the generator primary frequency response, which we refer to as governor response, and load response in the province. Then once we go into the few seconds into the after that time frame, we get into secondary frequency control. We're talking about seconds now, and that's where we talk about automatic generation control or AGC. That kind of acts as a control in that space as well. And then we have the tertiary frequency control. That's when we do direct contingency reserves to manage a system event so that we're able to come back to our nominal frequency and balance supply and demand at 60 hertz. So this is kind of the high level overview. And all of these things need to work in tandem, especially the primary frequency control, if we are to make sure that we don't get into UFLS territory. June 7th event, all of you are familiar with this, so I won't go into details. We had LSSI armed of 188 megawatts. The imports was around 923 megawatt. Wind generation was high around 930. The frequency when the event occurred because of a lightning strike on the BC side of 1201, the frequency dropped as low as 59.15, which resulted in the under frequency load shed program being activated, and we lost D1, D2, and D3 blocks, which is around 235 megawatt of load in the province. And this is just a frequency chart just to bring back the kind of the event and where the frequency landed in terms of 59.15 hertz. And what is significant is not just the nadir point, but also the fact that it hovered around 59.5, and that also resulted in activation of the UFLS blocks because of that. And part of it had to do with the generator response pullback that we noticed later on. As explained on this slide, the inertia was low because obviously we had high intertie flows and high amount of renewables on the system at that point. Was around 47 GVA second. Generally, we've studied around between 50 and 60. And keep in mind, I'm talking about the studies that were done at that point in time. Generator response, which we did see go down, from 77 megawatt per 0.1 hertz to about 40 megawatt per 0.1 hertz during that event. And that's what led to the hovering around 59.5 hertz, which is an additional UFLS triggering. We also consider load response in these events, and it was around 2.5% was the load damping constant, which means that for 1% change in frequency, we saw around 2.5% of load drop or load response during that event. This is like the generation response that we have historically had since 2012, and from the scatter plot you can see it is the response is quite scattered, where we saw the generator response at that time, I would want you to focus on the last towards the right hand of the chart, where the orange square kind of highlights the June 7th event. And like I mentioned, we had a generator response of about 77 megawatt per 0.1 hertz. Then the later on events was the October 16th event, which is kind of in the similar ballpark, as you can see from the circle. And then the two events down in 2021, which has a cross and a square overlap in blue. So those are again in the 67 megawatt per 0.1 hertz range. In terms of a generation response. And this is the load response that we saw for these events. As you can see, the load damping constant varies from 2.5 to all the way down to 1% during the October 16th event. And this is interesting. And we tried to do some analysis around weekend and weekdays. So as you can see from the naming convention, the weekends are the smaller annotations, and the weekdays are the bigger ones. We really could not see a distinct trend between how the load responding on a weekend versus weekday. It's so that's something to keep in mind. This is basically just to refresh everyone's memory in terms of the system response that we saw on June 7th of last year. And in terms of an overall response, we did get about 115 megawatt per 0.1 hertz. But we did see lower responses in October 16th event, and that's the circle, and then the cross, that's the Feb 21st event. We did see lower responses during those events. And in terms of mitigation measures that we used back after the June 7th event, we definitely redid the studies. We wanted to get more in terms of the lower, we wanted to capture the lower response from generators in the province as part of the study. So we did update the tables that most of you are familiar with. There are two tables currently that help us in terms of how much LSSI we need to arm. So there's the table 7A that's used in normal operating conditions as part of the ID that's there on your screen. And then there's an extreme weather event table that we have in place as well to account for inclement weather conditions around the 1201 line. And that is specifically because of a much higher probability of the line tripping during inclement weather events when you look at the past 10-year historical outage reasons. And the other piece that we implemented after June 7th was basically looking at system inertia, because we do have inertia concerns in the province, especially as we flow more over the tie line and with increasing penetration of renewables in the province. And we, based on studies, we established a threshold, and that's basically a ratio that calculates the ratio between contingency versus system inertia. And then we need to make sure that the ratio needs to be lower than a particular value, which is 0.0135. And if we don't, if the ratio rises higher, then we do curtail ATC to make sure reliability of the grid is maintained in the presence of a lower inertia in the system. And October 16th event last year, we did not have VFLS event, but I just wanted to highlight the conditions around that. The inertia was 54. You know, it was basically the Keeples unit that tripped at 267 megawatt, while the AIS, we were in an islanded mode of operation at that point. Like I mentioned, no UFLS was triggered, but we did not see a good response from the system, as you can see, both from a governor perspective as well as a load response cumulatively, which came to around 91 megawatt per 0.1 hertz. So I just wanted to highlight that piece, and I can explain in detail as to why we wanted to mention this here as well. And as you can see, the frequency chart, like I mentioned, we did not hit UFLS territory, but we did go low as low as 59.57 within 180 seconds after the first dip during that day, during the event. The mitigation measure that we put in place was basically at that point in time was we looked at the options that we had, and the two options primarily that we looked at were, you know, either we curtail generation because we don't want to create a shock to the system if we do lose a generator, you know, when we're in islanded operation, or we procure a lot of spinning reserves through our conscription directives to make sure that we have sufficient headroom, which in turn translates to making sure that we have sufficient primary frequency response from generators. Where we land, the fact that we could not have used LSSI, as that was not an option. LSSI is not available for operating during islanded operations, as you know. The solution that we implemented after the October 16th event was basically to curtail generation at that point in time to make sure that our largest contingency does not exceed 400 megawatts. And as you can see from the slide, you know, that was the most effective option instead of choosing buying a whole bunch of additional spinning reserves to manage the headroom aspect of things. And especially like I provided a brief overview in terms of the scatter plots, you could see that you know, the generator primary frequency response is something that we need to improve in the province, and that's something that we could not, you know, rely on to get us out of issues if we do get into a system issue and we end up in a UFLS territory. And that's the reason why we decided to curtail generation at that point. point in time. And now the more recent events, talking about February 21 and February 22. February 21, as all of you know, there was a permanent line to ground fault 150 kilometers from Bennett, still on the Alberta side at around 9:13 p.m. It was caused by high winds in the area, which led to the permanent line to ground fault. At that time, our load was around 10,173 megawatts. The flow on the tie line was around 440. There was high amount, a lot of wind generation in the province, around 1,270 megawatt of wind. The inertia was around 53.9, and there was no LSSI armed at that time, given that we were only flowing about 440 megawatt over the tie line. Post-event, as all of you know, we did go through UFLS Block D2 trip. We lost about 125 megawatt of load, roughly for about 15 to 20 minutes, as per information that we've got from the DFOs. We did lose generation as well during the event, both on the transmission and distribution side, which was around 120 megawatts cumulatively. And this kind of graph explains the impact of the generation trip that had on the event and a primary driver for us going into UFLS and activating D2 block, which is basically if your frequency stays at or below 59.5 for 30 seconds, our frequency dropped to 59.44 on that day. And as you can see from the slide, the curve, there is a distinct bend in the curve. At 59, just above 59.5, that takes us below 59.5 hertz. And that was the instance when the units tripped in the province. So it was a combination of losing the intertie as well as generation trip. So in a sense, the contingency then becomes much larger than just the 440 amount that was flowing on the intertie at that point in time. February 22nd, similarly, there was basically a face-to-face sustained fault. On the BC side, the 5L92, about 35 kilometers from Selkirk. This was caused by icing and as per information that we got from BC Hydro. We did have 201 megawatt of LSSI armed. We were operating at the severe weather table given the incident the previous day. So as a result of that, we did have about 201 megawatt of LSSI armed. And basically, at that point in time, the inertia was around 54. We had a good amount of wind on the system at 789 megawatts. The flow was around on the 1201 specifically, was around the 440 range. But we were also, when this contingency occurred on the BC side, we got about 200 megawatt of load on BC. Basically Cranbrook and Selkirk, we were basically sustaining that load. And that's why we have the flow listed at the actual 5L92. So basically we were carrying extra load on the BC side as well after the event. And post-event, we also lost a little bit of distribution connected generation, about 30 megawatts. And we did have the Ulysses LSSI trip, as expected, the armed LSSI trip. And there was no UFLS operation, though the frequency did drop to 59.48 for us. And that was the frequency nadir during that event. So again, just a refresher on the scatter plots. Like I mentioned, we did see lower generation primary frequency response, counter response during those events. And that has been a trend, as you can see in the scatter plot over the past four events, last year and this year, which is a concern for us. The load, it is not easy to pinpoint the load response that is kind of all over the map, so to speak, from a healthy 2.5%, that's kind of the average we would expect in the province, to around in the low ones, around ones, and then back to a healthy 2.7% back on February 22nd. It's really difficult to pinpoint the exact reason as to the load response characteristics. And this is the overall system response. Like I said, in terms of the combination of generator primary frequency response and the load response cumulatively. And this is what you can see. We were in the 90s for the October 16 and the Feb 21 event, but we were around 120, 110, 120 for the June 7th and the October 22nd event overall. So the mitigation measures that we applied post February 21st was basically, we did use the severe weather table, like I mentioned. So that went into effect February 22nd until March 4th. We are no longer on the severe weather table. And then we did revise the normal operating table. We added additional volumes to the LSSI armed, and that was based on system studies conducted to mimic the February 21st event. And this is where the system studies landed, that we needed to have this extra amount of LSI armed in order to make sure that we don't activate the UFLS program. And we also have lower arming at lower flows on the intertie as well as a result. And this table, or the new table 7A, did go into effect on March 4th, 2021 at our ending 12. The one thing that we wanted to highlight was the rate of change of frequency. This graph gives you that view. And again, the average rate of change of frequency that we observed is around 0.25 hertz per second. June 7th last year, I think the rate of change of frequency got to 0.45 hertz per second. And that is a concern when we talk about rate of change of frequency. And we do know other jurisdictions do consider rate of change of frequency in some of their mitigation measures as well. So this is just to bring that point up, that June 7th, we did have a higher rate of change of frequency during that event. Stakeholder engagement process. So since then, we have been actively engaged in talking to all the GFOs in the province at multiple levels, and at various business unit level as well, be it technical, be it commercial, be it markets. And we followed up multiple times with a lot of, and they were, highly engaged through the process, and they have submitted a lot of the technical reports that we have wanted to pinpoint specific issues or concerns or operating circumstances during these events, and they have submitted the reports towards the end of last year. We also worked with TFOs and SSI service providers to identify issues they had in terms of relay settings, in terms of any misoperations that we have seen during the June 7th event, and also with LSI service providers, if they had any concerns and we did come up with mitigating measures in terms of some of the LSI service providers and the areas that we wanted to look into. We engaged other ISOs and RTOs, as well as regional organizations such as WEC and the Northwest Power Pool. ISOs and RTOs specifically were ERCOT, and that's one of the primary reasons, because other ISOs like the Mid-Continent ISO or PJM does not have the same kind of concerns because they are strongly interconnected to their neighboring areas, whereas the fast frequency response piece and the frequency response issues is more of a concern for entities like ERCOT, for the Australian electricity market operator in Australia, and for Ireland as well, IRGRID. And we did have conversations with them, as well as follow-up in terms of literature reviews from those ISOs and RTOs, as well as review of NERC literature and the guidelines that NERC has published in terms of mitigating frequency response concerns. So, like I mentioned, the GFOs were highly engaged in the province to understand the reasons as to why we are seeing lower levels of primary frequency response. Just wanted to highlight the fact that there were no compliance concerns from the ISO, and there were legitimate reasons as to why we did see declining PFR. And some of the findings that we got during the engagement process is basically, and I can walk you through those findings at a high level. the DCS system at plants, the distributed control systems at plants. Some of them are legacy systems that were built 10, 20 years ago. And the design, apart from the design aspects, you know, we did see that some of the DCS operation did interfere with the unit's natural frequency response to system events. What we also observed was the most of the gas turbines, a lot of gas turbines in the province, they run on baseload operation unless they are participating in the operating reserve market. Obviously, they are sensitive to ambient temperature. For example, an LM6000, you know, even if it's rated at 45, 48 megawatts, during the June 7th event when the ambient temperature was around 11 degrees centigrade, we could not get more than 35 or 37 megawatt from an LM6000 50 megawatt unit. So definitely gas turbines are sensitive to ambient temperature. And the other aspect is when we have cogens in place, we have visibility at the asset level, but we don't have visibility at the unit level, specific unit level, as to how the gas turbine interacts with the steam turbine at the cogen facility. So that was something that we have since that we are looking into as a mitigating measure. What we also observed was at certain sites, there was a plant level controller that was overriding the units, specific individual units troop response or natural response. So as to maintain flows based on, dispatch, ISO dispatch. So there was a net output control at the plant level. Then there was a sliding pressure control mode, and this is applicable to some coal assets which operate in the sliding pressure mode as opposed to a constant pressure mode. And what that basically means is when they're operating between 25% and 75% of their MC, they tend to be less frequency responsive under this mode as compared to some of the other modes that they can operate in. We also noticed that some assets had a cap on group response as to how much they were providing during a system event that was capped. We noticed a suspected ADC signal mismatch or a conflict between ADC signals and some certain class of assets, which led to response withdrawal from these assets. We also noticed that a specific OEM has a ramp rate control setting in their gas turbine units. So it is not an immediate response that we get from this manufacturer equipment, but the response is more at a ramp rate type of a response that it's basically more ramped than an immediate response that we observed. So in terms of the recommendations and the ISO approach, like I mentioned earlier, we looked at event analysis, we did a whole bunch of engineering studies, we had tons of discussions with the GFOs, we did jurisdictional reviews, as well as looked at literature from NERC and WEC and some of the other reliability entities in North America. The recommendations that we have are holistic in nature, so they not only address the primary frequency response aspect, but they also address kind of secondary frequency response as well. They kind of look at other aspects like net demand variability, which is not really linked to frequency response, but we wanted to make the recommendations as holistic as we can in terms of operational preparedness in managing a future grid that the ISO would need to operate in a reliable and safe manner. The path forward, some of the implementation is with everything that the ISO does, we want to make sure that we have clearly identified there's a need, there's a benefit to grid reliability, and we would be conducting strenuous technical studies and impact assessments to identify a need and any solution that can provide a beneficial impact to an issue. We would definitely make sure that we address issues with efficient and effective solutions that align with our market framework. We will make sure that our proposals, once we finalize those proposals, we engage in a coordinated approach. As you know, there are other roadmaps that the ISO has, flexibility roadmap, the DER roadmap, then the storage roadmap. We want to make sure that the approach that we take as part of the learnings that we have from these events are coordinated with some of those roadmaps. and we will follow the ISO's due stakeholder engagement process as we go along the mitigation measures. So in terms of the short-term recommendations that we have had, and the aim is that we should get these done this year, earlier this year, is basically the use of inertia as the third parameter. Right now, we're currently doing studies. As you know, right now, it's the arming of LSI is based on how much flow is there on the intertie, as well as, what's the internal Alberta internal load. We plan to add a third parameter that looks at the inertia of the overall system and then see how much we need to arm based on a combination of these factors. Situational awareness, that's another piece that we want to implement in the control room that we are already underway. We are taking that approach in phases. The aim of the situational awareness piece is to have an expected system frequency response display in the control room for system operators, system controllers, and then be able to identify mitigation measures that may need to be taken if we do see concerning expected frequency response in real time. Then we would also look at operational preparedness during islanded operations as to what we think we need to do to ensure the stability of the system during islanded operations in the event a contingency were to occur. The last two bullets are not specific to primary frequency response issues, but just in terms of overall how the ISO is heading towards increasing amount of renewables on the system and the increasing net demand variability that something like that brings, apart from inertia issues. The net demand variability is something that we need to work with. And definitely we want to make sure we optimize our AGC, our regulating reserves, to ensure that we're able to balance net demand variability so that we don't get into compliance issues on the CPS2 benchmark from NERC. And we are also looking to improve wind and solar forecast accuracy. Right now, our system controllers have RAMP reports and a whole bunch of reports that they can access to in terms of what the forecast would look like and any RAMP events that might be related to wind and solar. In terms of the medium-term recommendations, 21-22 timeframe, we definitely aim to initiate some ID revisions to the technical rules. Like you see here, there are a couple of areas, the generating unit requirements and the operating reserve technical rules, where definitely based on feedback, we definitely think there are some areas of improvement that we can address in terms of providing additional clarity on what the expectation would be in terms of frequency response from generators and how they need to comply with the existing technical rules. So that would be underway. We definitely want to improve our modeling processes and move away from the concept of MARP, maximum authorized real power, because as you know, outputs vary and incorporate summer and winter rating models for generator units like some of the other ISOs have done, as opposed to just looking at MARP as a benchmark, so that this captures the seasonality associated with thermal units, especially gas turbines. Technical study to look into the feasibility of incorporating synthetic inertia in the AIS. And this is for inverter-based resources, and to see if we can, if it, from a technical point of view, is there a benefit if we were to look at synthetic inertia from assets, from such as wind resources. We will also plan to explore the feasibility of automatic duct and peak firing with certain generators. We know that there are certain generators that have duct firing and peak firing in manual mode, and we want to engage with them to see if there's any way they can automate some of that. So it definitely helps us during a reliability event or system event when we can lean on some of those extra megawatts if you're able to. And we plan to work with the GFOs to modify RAMP rates for response during system events, if that is possible. Like I mentioned, there is a manufacturer that has RAMP rate limitations during system events, and we're hoping to improve that in any way that we can, working with the GFO and the manufacturer to the extent possible. In terms of the long-term recommendation, this is over the two to three years time frame. We are going to explore the possibility of potentially looking at new ancillary service products. Like I mentioned, lack of headroom is a concern. Lack of primary frequency response is a concern. And we know ERCOT, for example, has addressed this issue through additional products, and that's something that we want to look into. And at this point, it's just looking at the technical feasibility to see if additional products of any new ANSI service products that helped us give us more headroom and address the frequency response issue at the same time would be beneficial in the long run. We also want to look at the dynamic ATC requirements, slow versus fast. Some of you know this is in play in some of the other ISOs, especially it takes advantage of newer technology that comes is getting integrated into the market, such as energy storage, and how this can play a role in terms of helping us with the response, as well as making sure that we are able to have a sustained response, even if we get into a system event. Then we also want to work with the generator facility owners to make sure that their natural response of their assets do not conflict with ADC signals. And this will be helpful so as to ensure that their generators don't withdraw response because of a conflict with the ADC signals that they're getting. We definitely want to be proactive in terms of monitoring during system events, and possibly looking at a performance metric standard similar to what ERCOT has in its BALTRE standard. It's basically actually measuring generator response during events and trying to establish benchmarks around how much should be expected. So that's something that we want to look at as a long-term view. And last but not the least, obviously, we want to be engaged with the community, with the stakeholders, as well as share learnings with the ISOs and RTOs and organizations such as FEC and NERC, and see if there's anything else that we can either provide them guidance on, or we can learn from them. So in terms of conclusion or next steps, the main aim is to continue to closely monitor system events and system performance. We want to give as many updates as possible, but we'll definitely make sure that we analyze the reasons, and we will definitely be monitoring system events closely. Even if there is no UFLS, even if there's no UFLS program getting activated, we'll make sure that we consistently keep top of these system events. We will continue to collaborate with industry stakeholders, with all of you, GFOs, TFOs, the other ISOs, RTOs, reliability organizations. We will continue that collaboration. Technical studies, like I said, there are areas that we need to look into in terms of technical studies like synthetic inertia, ADC conflict issues, dynamic ADC, new products to the extent possible. So we would be conducting those technical studies and reviews. And then obviously, in terms of ISO timelines, like I mentioned, the short, medium, and long-term recommendations. And as well as part of the ongoing process would be to provide you regular updates on where we are, what we're doing, and what the thinking process is around some of these, some of the recommendations that we might bring to you, or at least our thinking process as we go down this road. That's pretty much it for the initial presentation. I think you guys all know how to reach us, contact the ISO. This is not my slides. I'm going to be bumping through it, but yeah, Twitter, email, and website, it's all there. Thank you. This is all we had in terms of presentation. And then we would like to open the floor to Q&As.
Thanks, Biju. Obviously, Biju went through that material fairly quickly. If you have any questions, we'll take them now. This material will be posted on our website if it's not already posted, so that you have access to it. And I think one individual had their hand up, or now there's two. So we'll go to those that have their hands raised, and I'm going to ask Diane if you can free them up to be able to start with. Let's start with Chanel.
Hi, Chanel. You should be free to talk now.
Perfect. Thank you for the presentation. It's Chanel Sinclair, Heartland Generation. We certainly appreciate that everyone needs to work with the ISO to ensure reliability. One question I had on your slides, is there any review of the current 2020 procurement that's currently in progress for LSSI in terms of making sure that there are adequate volumes of LSSI for the ISO to arm? Is that something you're considering?
I'll take that one, Bijou. So yeah, we're actually, I think, at the selection stage on that procurement for 2022 is when that starts from a contract perspective. We did go out for a larger range of LSSI and we'll be looking to procure incremental through that process. And once we close with those parties, we will inform the industry the level to which we have LSSI procured now going forward. As far as sufficiency, I think we'll continue to see how things unfold here on the network as to whether we believe we need additional LSSI as well. And this last procurement, we opened it up as much as we could to other players in the industry to see if they would be interested in participating and offering their load services into the product. And we did get some new players, so that's positive. I think the industry should also be aware that we have launched another technology agnostic pilot from an LSSI or a fast frequency service response perspective, where we're going out for another 50-ish or so megawatts, primarily targeted at energy storage or any other technology that can bring to bear that type of fast frequency response. We want to test out that technology and see how well it works, and then we'll go from there. Bijou, anything to add to that? Or?
No, I think that you've covered that, yeah. And just for a reminder, the FFR pilot project would be launched on March 24th. So in terms of the timeline, yeah.
Thanks, Bijou. I think there was another individual that had their hand raised. Diane?
David Michaud from TransAlta, you should be free to talk.
Hello, yes. Thank you. I have a quick question. So this is in reference to the slide on the short-term things for 2021 with net demand variability. Can you just explain generally at a high level? So I think what you said was system studies to develop optimized regulating reserve volumes to manage net demand variability. What, just generally, what is that?
For sure. So basically, like I mentioned, this one is not specific to primary frequency response issues, but more of a holistic view at the ISO to prepare us for what the future is. And what we so AGC is one of the tools that we have in our toolkit to manage the net demand variability, as you know, which is increasing because of higher amount of intermittent resources on the grid, wind and solar. And what we do is regularly conduct technical studies to ascertain the amount of regulating reserves that we're carrying. And, you know, in terms of making sure that we have enough reserves to manage NDV so as to not to get into any reliability standard issues and be within the CPS2 compliant framework. And that's pretty much that we want to ascertain, is that we will keep monitoring as more and more renewables, more wind comes online, more solar gets connected, as you know, more and more solar generation is getting added to the queue as well as generation. They produce a high level of variability associated with the resources, natural variability. And all the slide is saying is that we will continue to monitor them, continue to do studies to make sure that we're carrying an appropriate amount of, an optimized amount of regulating reserves that we need to manage the grid in a reliable manner.
And just in case you aren't clear what we're talking about when we say net demand variability, maybe Bijou, you can just explain what we're talking about there as far as ramps and variability.
Sure. Yeah, so it's basically any time you have a load and then you have, it's basically the exclusion of the renewable resources. And when we look at the variability of renewable resources, it's quite variable compared to an output from a thermal generation or any other form of generation. And as it's basically dependent on how much wind is hitting the turbines and how much the solar radiation is impacting the solar panels, and cloud cover can have an impact on the amount of solar radiation that the panels are receiving, as well as wind can change speed and direction depending on the various circumstances. So it's a combination of that as opposed to which we consider as variable as compared to a thermal plant, which is must, in terms of constant output and things like that. And that variability, that we, it's a challenge to for the ISO to make sure that we are on top of that variability when it comes to dealing with intermittent resources.
Thanks, Biju. So as we get more wind and solar on the system, we're starting to see different ramp rates of that variability as the wind and sun drives the output. And it's that ramping in the short term, 10 minutes, hour, the variability that we're trying to both forecast as well as manage on the system.
Dennis, in line with that question, Lance Belanger has asked, will the ISO forecast and publish when they will be utilizing severe weather tables?
Sorry, is that, I didn't quite catch that, Diane, I didn't quite hear.
Oh, sorry. It's, will the ISO forecast and publish when they will be utilizing the severe weather tables?
Well, I don't know the answer to that question. Right now, I would say no. The operators are in real time assessing what the weather risk is looking like, either lightning or wind or any other severe storms that might be heading across 1201 line from a risk perspective. So I don't think we're going to ask our operators to either forecast or predict. They're just going to move to action when that occurs. If there's something beyond that that the individual wants to ask, then I'm up to having that question asked.
And a question that has had a lot of upvotes from Joseph Van Ellenberg from TransAlta is, we have seen a change to the positive in ancillary volumes. Can we expect a similar quantity to be purchased going forward?
It, in terms of ancillary service volumes, because the, so just to be clear, I'm not sure if I'm getting the answer correctly, but I'll try to frame the answer. The relative reserves are based on technical studies and optimization, like I just talked about. The contingency reserves are based on standards that we have to procure a certain amount of contingency reserves, spinning and supplemental, and that's specified in the standard, and 50% of contingency reserve has to be spinning. So I'm not sure exactly what, and definitely we will make sure that contingency reserve procured has to be consistent with, you know, what we see as the most severe single contingency. Is the MSSC, it's either the Genesee unit tripping, or is it the inflow on the tie line, or is it a 3+3 generation, net generation of 3+3 load? And that's all specified in the liability standard that we follow when we're procuring volumes. Given the fact that we are a day ahead ancillary service market, so there is a bit of forecast that goes into what we need to procure for the next day. But that's kind of pretty much what we have in terms of the guiding principles in terms of how we procure reserves. So I don't know if that helps.
Yeah, so just to add on to that, for clarity, Joseph, we have not changed any of our standards or processes that would be deliberately driving an increase in ancillary services. Obviously, LSSI aside, because it's clear what we've been doing on the LSSI side. So I think Biju and I are not quite following the positive in ancillary volumes, because we haven't deliberately been doing anything to increase the volumes. We've been working to optimize the volumes from a regulating reserve perspective, depending on what we're seeing on the system from a variability perspective. So hopefully that answered your question. If not, then try again, because it's difficult here. Or raise your hand and then we can just have a conversation.
So the next question is from Ian White. 5 other people support this. Ian is with Shell. And he's asking, why is LSSI arming not an option for operating in islanded mode?
So you want that, Biju, or you want?
Yeah, you can go for it, Dennis. Yeah.
Okay. It comes down to essentially the terms of the contracts that have been placed with those service providers. The contract terms are clear, It's for import conditions, and therefore, in order to be used, you have to be connected in importing. And it's not, the terms were not set up for utilizing LFSI under an islanded situation. That said, we are looking at, as Bijou indicated, what options we have under an islanded situation in order to deal with the risk of loss of generation and dropping into under frequency load shed. Anything to add to that, Bijou?
No, Dennis, I think you've covered it.
Okay.
No, thank you.
Okay, Joseph, I see you raised your hand, so we'll...
Please go ahead. Get...
Yeah, thank you very much. This is just a question about the active ancillary reserves, just contingency reserves in general. We saw about 100 meg drop in June last year, and that persisted all the way until February. And in February, we saw that jump back up by 100 megs and continue forward. I was just wondering if that 100 meg delta that we saw from the second half of last year will continue, or if that was some kind of optimization on your part.
Sure, Dennis. Yeah, this is something that we might have to take offline or maybe go through written format, but we did optimize regulating reserves last May, and so that resulted in a drop in the amount of regulating reserves we procured. But CR, like I've mentioned, it's based on reliability standard, the active reserve component, and standby, we are looking at optimizing the standby market volumes because that is primarily required based on Alberta. But I'm not sure if we're talking about 100 megawatt decline and then bring back up.
Just in June last year, we saw active contingency reserve acquired dropped by about 100 megs. And then that persisted all the way until February. And then February, we saw that 100 megs jump back up. But yeah, if that has nothing to do with this, I'm fine. I was just wondering if you had any color for that.
Yeah, okay. Not at this point, Jeff. Yeah, it's, yeah.
Thanks.
Look into it. But yeah, it could just be a forecast. And then, you know, once a spring runoff happens in Q2, you know, once that's done, then we go back to our MSSC. You know, it's less of a concern in terms of it's more of 3+3 that sets the CR requirement for a lot of the time around the year. So
explain the 3+3 quick. So.
Sure. So it's the 3% of net generation and 3% of net load that could potentially, in most cases, it is the largest contingency that we have to procure reserves to. And some of the decline that you may be seeing may be coming out of the fresher to spring runoff season when we procure, because we think there could be a higher flow on the intertie, to moving into a more stable CR procurement mechanism, which looks at, you know, in that case, 3% of net generation plus 3% of net load might have been the MSSC. And that's probably why you saw some of the numbers moving around. Like I said, it's we have to make sure that we're carrying reserves to a max of either the largest unit in the province stripping, which is 466 megawatts, or it's the 3% net demand plus 3% net load, or it's the expected flow on the intertie. So
thank you very much.
Thanks, Bijou.
We've got people looking for a response to Ethan's question. In October 2020, how did the ISO determine 400 megawatts was a reliable MSSC quantity? Does the ISO foresee future events where MSSC reductions may constrain units within the province again?
Sure. I can take that one, Dennis. So yeah. Basically, the 400 megawatt is basically done on studies. When we did the studies, we found that to be a safe spot as to where we think the system should be stable if we were to include, if we were to have a 400 megawatt loss of generation. So that's based on system studies. In the future, as we get into, like I mentioned, we do have steps to mitigate some of the concerns that we see, and we would be continuing to engage in technical studies to make sure what the appropriate threshold would be if we were to get into a curtailment option, if we did not have other options at hand that we can resort to. But yeah, that's something that will be ongoing as part of our technical studies and other product services and support that we have and how the system progresses.
I think I'll just add to that, Bijou. If you take a look at the scatter plots of the load response that we've seen historically since 2012, or the generator response that we've seen since 2012, previously our studies would have been based, and our decisions as to how much LSSI and what we thought we could withstand from a loss perspective were based on a 50th percentile. the average response in that scatter plot. Now that we're starting to see more and more events in the lower quartile, I would say, both of the primarily from a generated response perspective, we have increased our confidence level by lowering from 50% to about the 90th percentile of events on the system, because we don't want to go into load shed on a 50-50 chance that we're going to get a certain response on the system. We've lowered it down to about 90% confidence, meaning if we get responses better than the 10th percentile worst case, we should be okay and not have to go into under frequency load shed. If we still get a response below that 90th percentile, we're at a good chance we're going to be into under frequency load shed. So that's the analysis that the team has been going through as we've been seeing events and the performance shift over time and increasing the probability that we're not going to go into under frequency load shedding as a result.
Thanks, Dennis. We're getting close to the top of the hour. Tyler is asking, with system inertia becoming more important, will it become a published value in real time?
System inertia is definitely one of the key parameters that we are looking at. Like I mentioned, situational awareness. We do have inertia monitoring. Like I mentioned, we have inertia as a determining factor for ATC reduction. We also have inertia going in as a third parameter for arming of LSSI in the coming months. And we do see inertia concerns as more and more renewables come on the line, inverter-based resources come online. So we're looking at ways how we can, as less and less rotating mass goes on the system, how do we manage that, through synthetic inertia, through other forms. But definitely we are on top of it and trying to figure out how best to address the inertia issues.
Yeah, I think, Biju, what Tyler was asking is whether we're going to publish it in real time. And I suspect it's related to having visibility from a market perspective. So we'll take both of those back. I suspect it's the same concern from a severe weather table and publishing that either from a forecast or real-time perspective. I will just need to do some review of how two things. One, how predictable and confident we are in what that information is, because we don't want to publish stuff that moves a lot and create that concern, but also how easy it is for us to do that in the ask. So we'll take that back and then we'll make a decision on that deliberately for both of those.
Makes sense.
So it's 11 o'clock. I'm not sure if you want to wrap things up. We have an hour scheduled. I do know that Biju is planning to take the questions away. We've got 18 more queued up here and committed to posting a response yet.
Well, so my preference is we'll take another 10 minutes. I'd rather go through the questions here live versus doing the manual written approach. Okay. For those that are able to stay on, great. If not, obviously this is recorded. You can go listen to the last 10 minutes as we go here. So let's keep going with the questions.
Okay. John Mulrooney is asking, can you further explain the decision to move from the 7B severe weather table for 2011-001R to the 7A table on March 4th, 2021? Should the ISO be acting more conservative in light of the events in October and February? And the second part of the question, can you please explain what constitutes severe weather?
Okay, I'll take a shot of that, Biju, and then you can clean up my mess. What constitutes severe weather is a judgment call that the operators in real time will make. They obviously have the ability to see weather systems moving into the area of the tie line, whether that's lightning storms, snowstorms, high wind events, those types of severe weather that increases the risk of tripping the tie. So that will be their decision-making in the control center in real time. As it relates to our decision to move from the severe weather table to the normal table, as Biju mentioned, we went through the analysis and determined that if we add about 50 megawatts to the LSSI normal table, which we have done, we are at the confidence level of about 90% confidence that we won't trip UFSLS. So with that change, we are confident to move to the normal table under normal weather conditions and stay there until a severe weather situation occurs. Under the severe weather situation, we add some incremental LSSI if we have it available because of the higher probability of tripping. And if it's not available, then we're going to reduce ATC from an opportunity import perspective to de-risk the situation under those weather conditions. Do you need to correct me anything there, Bijou?
No, Dennis, no. Spot on.
Okay. The next question, has ISO done any analysis related to the correlation of the increasing level of renewables on the system inertia and what the forward-looking impact, the severity of frequency dips will be? Additionally, does this mean more LSSI service will be required moving forward?
That one's yours, Bijou.
Yeah, I can take that one. So in terms of moving forward with LSSI, I can answer that latter part first. Yes, so like I mentioned, the Alberta system is, as you know, there are interconnections to BC, Montana. And so we are weakly interconnected with the rest of WECC as compared to some of the other ISOs have. So we do see a need for sustained requirement for a fast frequency response. Be it in LSSI form, be it in the FFR pilot project, be it in any form that it takes towards being technology agnostic into the future. But we do see, like I always talk about, three legs of a stool, for example, inertia. We need to have inertia on a system. We need to have generator and load primary frequency response. And we need to have a fast frequency response to ensure that we don't activate the UFLS program. And that's something that we need to focus on. And LSSI, just one piece of that a metric that helps us as a fast frequency response kind of helps us avoid the UFLS program. The other piece is the look ahead piece. Yes, like I mentioned, the program that we have at the ISO is holistic and is a look ahead in terms of addressing the various three components that I talked about, but also the secondary frequency response in terms of AGC and conflicts and dynamic AGC and those kind of work that we have. So it is kind of a look ahead from that perspective, as well as that we're planning not just for the current event-based analysis, but we're also looking into what we need to do to make sure we're prepared as more and more renewables connect to the grid in the future.
And just to tag on to that, Bijou, obviously we're in the LTO process right now as an organization. And as we look at those long-term outlook scenarios that are going out 20 years, we'll look at the reference case and the higher renewable output case and do our inertia and frequency response studies and analysis on that long-term outlook as well to see where that's heading and what implications that has on the system and plan action in front of that as we go.
Thanks, Dennis. Sarinja Singh with Alberta Newsprint has asked, have ISO explored using LSSI during islanding with necessary changes in the LSSI contract?
Yeah, we're looking at both the option to adjust the contract and see if current LSSI service providers are prepared to offer the service when we're in an islanded situation. We're also looking at what the, and there's a cost benefit for that. We're looking at constraining generation, or I'll call it the largest generator down, or largest generation down to 400 if it happens to be in the merit order at the time, and the cost benefit of that. And we're in that analysis right now as to which is a better path to take, recognizing we've got binding contracts with LSSI service providers right now, and that would take a negotiation and potentially a different process for procurement of that product. So yes, we're looking at both, and we'll make a decision here this year as to whether we go one way or the other.
Thanks, Dennis. Matthew Davis with Capital Power has asked, the ISO has limited the MSSC to 400 megawatts when islanded in October and February. Do any of the proposed recommendations change this?
Like Dennis mentioned, we're looking at various options we have at the point. So given the October 16th event, it was very specific. The action taken was very specific to the 16th event, but we are looking at options in terms of the reduction piece versus the LSSI for island operation piece. And we still are ways into getting the final decision made on that front.
Thanks, Biju. Matt Aries has asked, can you share the event analysis reports rather than just the PowerPoint?
I think my quick response to that is no, Matt, we're not going to share all the detailed technical event analysis reports. I think if you have some specific questions that you're trying to get answered, then feel free to reach out to Biju and he can go through responses to that. I don't think we've written the reports to be released, published. And so that would take a fair bit of work to do. And obviously there's a lot of interpretation within that analysis that I'm not a fan of just releasing and then having to deal with everybody's interpretation of the results. So we've tried to be transparent here at this level of information that we've provided. If there's incremental you need, then feel free to reach out to Biju or myself for that matter.
And just to add to Dennis, we do have detailed technical reports and studies done, but they are commercially sensitive. So we pinpoint, there are names and assets specified. And so it's at a level that we would not want to,
Thanks for adding that on, Biju. Appreciate it.
Thanks. Dan Shield has asked, it appears GEMS tripped post 1201L trip, where there are no violations of existing ISO GEM rules.
That is correct, yes. We are more into how DCS operates and what the issues, like I mentioned, the findings were. They are not a violation of compliance standards, like droop setting, for example, at 3 to 5% that we specify, or you need to be frequency responsive. There are a lot of other factors at play. So we could not find any issue with any generator asset being non-compliant or not in line with the existing standards as written.
And I think the only thing I would add to that, Biju, obviously we've had, four or more events on the system over the last little bit. We only had one situation where that I'm aware of, that we had generators trip. And it was about 120 megawatts through that frequency event. So it's not a common repeat occurrence. And we're obviously diving into that, those few generators that tripped during that event to make sure we understand why and see if we can mitigate it going forward.
Thanks.
Thanks.
Shaquille
Pan has asked, as a long-term mitigation plan, are there any plans to have more interties with our neighboring systems?
Well, I think I would describe that as the ultra long-term mitigation plan, because in order to get interties, we're talking decades. we're not looking at incremental interties as far as with neighboring systems as part of our long-term or near-term or medium-term mitigation plans here. We're going to be working with what we've got and being able to optimize and address the issue as best we can with the tools we'd have available without driving incremental interties.
Okay, the next question, the presentation is going to be posted to the ISO's website following this session and will be available for download. And it's going to be under market initiatives, ETC operations. Okay, my next question, you mentioned in your mitigation measures slide that you will look at your incremental volumes to LSSI and arming below 500 megawatts. But how will you mitigate it if there are insufficient LSSI volumes offered in?
So Alyssa, insufficient volumes, that's so the option that we have is basically curtail the ATC. So at any point in time, we make sure that we need to be compliant with standards and operate them reliably. So if we don't have insufficient LSI, what we do is basically curtail ATC in real time.
At this point, does the ISO have an idea what would be the inertia ratio or range for future implementing the metric as one of the criteria for arming LSSI?
So we are kind of the studies are underway as we speak, and we're looking at bookends as well. Like I mentioned, a good healthy inertia is around 50 to 60 GVA a second. We saw 47s and 43 GVA a second, but we're also trying to study when the inertia goes really low in the 20s and 30s GVA a second as well, and trying to see what kind of system response we get. So we're kind of looking at bookends, and the study would capture pretty much at this point the entire range between 25 to 50, 60 GVA second.
Thanks, Vijay.
And recognizing we will have then inertia as one of the parameters in the control center for setting the arming table. So we'll know if we've got really low inertia where we need to be on an LSSI table, or if we've got decent inertia where we need to be. So it'll be a little more dynamic in the establishment of that in the control center.
Thanks, Dennis. Bob Howlands asks, what is the ISO's estimate of incremental cost to ratepayers for all the studies and mitigation measures the ISO has taken to accommodate no inertia, solar and wind, renewables becoming a larger percentage of system generating resources?
Let me take that one, Bijou, and then see, Bob, if you have incremental questions on that. I do want to emphasize, and you can see in the responses we've been getting from an inertia perspective, that there's quite a range of inertia response on the system. And so it's dependent on who's in the merit order, who's connected on the system at the time. And so it's variable. So that said, I would suggest we have done the technical studies that we've needed to do to understand where inertia is at and where it's potentially going. We would not have done a cost benefit associated with the change in inertia. Our obligation right now is to ensure we've got a reliable system and manage the risk of what we're seeing currently. And as Bijou mentioned, we're looking at in our recommendations whether we can access synthetic inertia in the really early response part of the primary frequency response from those types of resources, wind and solar. And so there's other jurisdictions that have moved that way already. And so I wouldn't necessarily call renewables no inertia. I think there's opportunity for synthetic inertia, and that's part of the decision-making we need to go forward with here. And so maybe, Bijou, you probably have more details on the synthetic inertia side of it. Maybe you can just share a little bit on our learnings there.
For sure. And especially in terms of synthetic inertia, technology has come a long ways since the years when it was proposed or when it was implemented in wind turbines. And like Dennis mentioned, we do know of Hydro-Quebec, SaskPower, who have synthetic inertia standards in place. Ontario is moving towards that as well. And a lot of ISOs and jurisdictions around the globe have already adopted synthetic inertia. We are conducting technical studies. And like I mentioned in one of my slides earlier, is that we will make a full impact assessment of any solution or recommendation that we would come forward with, including impact markets and working within the markets framework as well. So we would cross that bridge when we get there. Right now, we're just focused on doing the technical study to see if there is benefit in terms of incorporating synthetic inertia for inverter-based resources in the province.
And as Bijou indicated, that piece of our action plan is in the 2021-2022 time period. So we'll be making decisions in that time period as to how we're going to move that part forward.
Tyler Drever is asking, are you contemplating any changes or enhancements to your technical documents and expectations around frequency of fonts?
That's right, Tyler. We do plan to make sure that we provide additional clarification in terms of what we expect from a frequency response or system event perspective. And that's something that we plan to tackle early on in terms of providing more clarity around what is expected, in terms of a frequency response from assets which have headroom and which are managing their droop response to between 3% and 5%.
Yeah, and so obviously two things there. What we found in all the conversations with the GFOs is that our ID or rule maybe aren't as clear as they could be in order to interpret our existing rules and IDs. And so what Bijou's talking about is, okay, what do we need to do to make it clearer what our expectations are? That's different than going down a path to change the rule and the expectations within the performance standards right now. We'll follow our AUC Rule 17 as far as stakeholder engagement on any of the IDs or rules that we're considering to change. And so you can expect we'll be working through that process here in 2021 as it relates to any of the changes that we're proposing to take forward, whether they're clarifications and more administrative or material changes that we're considering. We'll engage the industry accordingly.
Thanks. The next question is, you have answered that in the event of insufficient LSSI is offered, you would look at reducing intertie. But as an alternative, are you looking at other OR products or increasing existing OR volume to avoid that?
Take that one. So and that's the reason why I put this chart at the front, which looks at the frequency continuum space. And LSSI is basically a fast frequency response product, which we need in the first few seconds or cycles. As you may be familiar, we need to trigger LSSI within 12 cycles of an event from occurring. Operating reserves don't work on the same time span as fast frequency response and inertia and those kind of factors work. Regulating reserves is more in the seconds to minute time frame. In our technical rules itself, we have specific requirements that says you need to move regulating reserves in 28 seconds, 40 seconds. So that's kind of the time frame we look at when we're talking about AGC. And currency reserves, obviously, they have 10 minutes to go to their directed levels, which is much longer time frame than what would happen. So there's a different time frames that we're talking about. So just by increasing reserves does not get us to that point. There is some consideration for additional headroom that we have that we could gain through increased amount of reserves, but that's something that we're looking into. And that's where the headroom component needs to be split into two. One is just the pure headroom for the megawatt amount, and then there's a frequency responsive component of that headroom as well. And we need to make sure that when we do propose just increasing reserves or a new product like ERCOT has, we need to be mindful that we are addressing both issues at the same time, and not just a headroom conversation, but at the same time, being able to provide the frequency responsiveness we need from that additional headroom which we procure. So quite a few things at play at this point.
Yeah, and I just want to emphasize, because sometimes people jump to conclusions a little bit. We're in the technical analysis stage of a lot of this. We're not in the, we've figured out first of all, that we need additional products and how we would potentially go procure them. That would be a later decision point. We're just doing the technical analysis now to determine if we need to do anything. Obviously, if we make the decision that we need to do something, then we'll be transparent in that. We understand the obligations from an industry engagement and a FEOC perspective and all the market implications. So I don't want to send the message that we're thinking of moving with any particular products, more services in this space. We're going to do the technical analysis first.
Thank you.
Bill, as it relates to your question, yes, the single bolt tripping and reclosing is still in place on the tie line. And yes, those events were three phase trips eventually. it might have been single pull trip, reclosed trip that went three phase, and it might have been phase to phase in some situations that went three pole right away. I understand BC Montana are in the same RAS scheme. No, the imports exports from the tie to Saskatchewan is not impacted by these events. It stays in place. There's not an issue with that.
Thanks, Dennis. Please briefly explain what a distributed control system is.
Bijou.
Sure. So that's basically the, I guess, the brain behind the generating asset function. So that's basically distributed control system. We mean is the entire operation at a plant is controlled from by the DCS. And that's basically all the, you know, if you've looked at Google Photos or things like that, it's kind of the hue. It's the brain behind the operation. It looks at valve settings. It looks at temperature, droop response. There are tons of information on that, and similar to a grid control screen where you see a lot of moving pieces, which even I'm not familiar with. So, but that's kind of the brain behind how a generating unit operates. Operates.
Plant level controller.
Thanks. After the Texas event, it was observed that the ISO worked from the backup control center on February 22nd before the trip event. Is that anything to do with checking the reliability of our grid and emergency measures?
Porna, that is impressive sleuthing on your part. No, it had absolutely nothing to do with Texas or grid reliability. What it was is at our main control center, we were doing a air conditioning replacement. And so we had that building shut down, and we therefore were in the backup control center while that facility upgrade was occurring at our main control center.
Thanks. And the final question, will the ISO consider a new market product load shedding service for islanded LSSI scenarios?
Well, I think we've answered that one already. We're obviously looking at under islanded situation, whether procuring the similar load shed service during that period is doable and what it would take. We're also looking at the other option of constraining generation from the largest generators below 400 megawatts as another option. Recognizing, you know, islanded operation occurs under a forced event for a period of time, and then occasionally it's a planned event on a kind of annual basis. So we'll factor that frequency of event into the decision making.
And now the final question regarding the RAS on the BC and Montana tie lines. I understand that if the BC tie trips, then the MATL tie trips as part of the RAS. Why doesn't the opposite occur when MATL tie trips? Why doesn't the BC tie trip as part of the RAS?
BG, you want that one? Or?
Sure, I can start with it. So the BC system is a stronger system. We're talking about 10,000, 11,000 megawatt system, whereas the Montana system is a weaker system. So if we lose BC, then there is a struggle in terms of you know, maintaining that connection with the weaker system down south of the border. But the reverse is not true. So when we do lose, if we were to lose MATL, we still connect it to a BC system, which is strong and can manage power swings and not so much a concern in terms of impacting reliability. And that's the one reason why we don't have, the BC tie line trip in the event MATL trip goes. And the RAS is there just to make sure that, that we don't harm reliability for weaker systems.
Thank you. Okay. I think that's all the questions, Diane.
It appears to be. Can I just mention the path one more time where folks can find the PowerPoint presentation, which should be posted shortly? You can find that on the ISO's website under Market Related Initiatives, Available Transfer Capability, Risk Mitigation, and Operational Preparedness. So again, that PowerPoint presentation will be posted shortly, and the audio file will be posted by the end of the week.
Thanks, Dan. Okay, well, I appreciate everybody joining the conversation. Hopefully it was helpful and productive, and you should stay engaged, and we'll continue to update you as we progress. Bijou and the team are continuing to work our actions forward, and we'll keep you informed as we go. So thanks for your time, and have a good week.
Thank you, everyone.
Yeah.